Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is David Dixon, professor of political science and chair of the Department of History at St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer, Indiana. Professor Dixon cut his chops in academia at the University of Notre Dame, where he earned his doctorate researching religion and politics in Latin America. However, he has more recently come to be known for a series of edited volumes on the U.S. civil rights movement. One of these volumes examines the role of women in that movement, and then there are two additional volumes that examine religious sermons and speeches entitled Rhetoric, Religion, and the Civil Rights Movement, 1954 to 1965, Volumes 1 and Volume 2. He co-edited these with his colleague David Davis Houck, a professor of communications at Florida State University. And as I've mentioned time and time again, you can always find links to these things at our website, www.researchonreligion.org. Dave, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Any excuse to catch up, Tony?
Yeah, I should let our listeners know that Dave and I go way back. We're roughly contemporaries, finishing our dissertations at about the same time. And we would hang out at various conferences, various Latin American studies conferences. The last I remember, and I remember it barely, I think it was in Jalisco, and it was sponsored by the tequila companies. And I can't even remember getting back to the airport. So that was a good conference, I think. But since that time, I've moved on from my interest in Latin America, and because I've decided that Dave is much better at Spanish than I ever was. So you get that field to yourself there. And now all of a sudden I find out here in 2014, you're working on the U.S. civil rights movement. How'd you get from being an expert on Chile and other South American countries to this series of books on religious rhetoric in America during the mid-20th century?
Well, first, relative to disciplines, I've always been promiscuous. I was, as an undergraduate at Wheaton College in Illinois, I was a double major in philosophy and political science, and I also studied journalism and was the editor-in-chief of the student newspaper there, the Wheaton Record. So I've always been sort of straddling a lot of things. That didn't mean that this was necessarily going to happen, but I have a propensity to just sort of move around. And in this case, a dear old friend and a friend that I have a lot in common with invited me repeatedly to write this massive project. It started out, the first volume was, it weighs 3 pounds, and the actual manuscript for it was about 1,700 pages, and the book is 1,002 pages.
Ooh.
And that actually snowballed into a second book and then a third book. And at the time, it was just a massive project, and we didn't know how big it was going to be. And I told him repeatedly, no, I don't want to do this.
I actually have to stop and mention that it's pretty cool that you measured this in pounds. I think we should be able to put that on our vitas, that, you know, how much work have you done? Oh, about 17 pounds of work. So
a 3-pound tome.
Yeah, I would use heavier paper, I think, because I don't write that often. So I need heavier, heftier stuff, I guess.
Well, at some point, my friends asked me, well, okay, but I'm having trouble finding out about these two contributors to this project. One named Robert Spike and the other named Bruce William Clunder. Can you just try to outline like a one-paragraph biography for each of them so that we know where to go with this? Because we want to say something about these people because they wrote important things, but we don't know anything about them. As I looked into this using all kinds of things, Google is useful, Zaba search is useful. I like Intellius. It does some weird things, if you're careful with it, that some of the others don't use. But little by little, we found out about these people, and it turned out that Robert Spike, just after he was appointed in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, was on campus to give a talk at Ohio State and was killed on campus. And the other guy was William Bruce Clunder, Bruce William Clunder, I'm sorry, who tragically went to a protest at a construction site, and it wasn't purposeful, but they knew, of course, that it was dangerous to be in places, construction places, but he was bulldozed to death in Cleveland. And here, my friend and I grew up on Route 71, halfway between Cleveland and Columbus, Ohio, in Mansfield, Ohio, and I'd never heard of either of these guys. And if I grow up right there and these two people die in really, really tragic, they were both very young when it happened, and I don't hear about it, and my whole life I've been interested in progressive religion, no one else was going to do it. It was my feeling, and so I was hooked.
Let me stop and back you up here a minute. Uh-huh. You're talking about Robert Spike and Bruce William Clunder. These guys were part of the civil rights movement, right?
Correct.
And who is this person getting you involved in this project that said,
David,
you got to look this up?
And then this is going to be a long story.
Okay.
Davis and I go back, let's see, about 1978 or 1979, Davis played against my brother in what we called a bitty basketball tournament or two. It was just little kids at Mansfield Friendly House. And so our families would have seen each other and vaguely recognized each other after a few of these tournaments. In 1981, his older sister, Sharon, became my racquetball partner, and we didn't really date. She mostly liked to beat me in racquetball. But I figured, what the heck, I'll invite her to prom. And so we went to prom. And at this point, there's an apocryphal story. And, you know, shut me down when I'm taking too long on this. But Mrs. Houck made lasagna when I went over to meet the family. And I didn't like her lasagna. And so I left like a half slab of this stuff. And I don't know why I didn't like it, but I just didn't. And I wouldn't admit it because it was just not in my background to admit it. But she confronted me and said, "Don't you like it?" And I said, "Well, my parents taught me British and continental European etiquette. And in continental Europe, they leave some food on the plate to let the hostess know that they're fully satisfied and had a wonderful meal." And she wouldn't let it go. She wanted to make me admit that I was lying, and I wouldn't do it. So we agreed to disagree, and that was the start of our family's interactions. At some point, I've stayed in touch with the Houcks. I went to Mrs. Houck's funeral. I've spoken with Mr. Houck recently on the phone. He's sharp as a tack, and I wish him excellent health for many, many more years, but I want his memory to get worse, at least relative to me, one of these days, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen soon.
Uh-oh. Yeah, he's going to hear this lasagna story now that's out on the interwebs.
Definitely. And so at some point, Davis and I ran into each other at Penn State and found out we read Max Weber very different, slightly differently than most people, and very similarly to each other. There's a word called something like Geltung, G-E-L-D-U-N-G, and I forget if there are diacritics somewhere in it. But most people call it legitimacy or legitimation, and both of us looked at this word Geltung and saw gold or gilder, or just the word Geld, money in German, and we translated it as currency. And there were a series of things like that that just kept us in touch over the years. And then by the time it was 2003 or 2004, and he was really intent on recruiting me for this project, we'd stayed in touch for a long time and knew each other's minds very, very well.
Mm-hmm. And he asked you to get involved in this project, and you said, "Yeah, well, let's do it." So where does it go from there?
Oh, wow. It was bigger than anyone thought. First of all, we go, a word on methods. We go to archives all over the place, and if we can get other people in archives to do stuff for us, we do that too. But in addition to archival stuff, we cold call people. We have to eventually talk to the families and get their permissions to be able to print this legally. And so we end up calling a lot of different people that have the same name as the person we are trying to get in touch with and finally get in touch with the person, and then oftentimes they'll say, hey, you know what, the one you're talking about, I don't remember, it doesn't sound familiar, but here are three or four others we have, you know, in storage somewhere, or in a, some people are very well organized and keep family files. In one case, I think Ed Harris's case in the first book in 2006, his wife was sworn to secrecy about the very painful incidences that had gone on within their church until after he passed at age 90. I think he was in his early 90s. And so there was just an awful lot of silence, and of course, with that, people are just ready when there's an opportunity to give to the project, and we were no longer astonished after the first few times it happened, but it's still an amazing process.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the nature of the book, too. I still want to hear more about the stories of how you found a lot of this, but one of the things that impresses me about your two-volume set on religion and rhetoric in the civil rights movement is that it doesn't go down the typical territory everybody else does. It doesn't look into Dr. Martin Luther King's speeches. Not to say that that's not important. They're very important. But there's a lot of things going on in the periphery to this movement that's not covered. And most of our attention seems to be focused toward the Southern Leadership Conference and a few other major figures in the movement. But this is a documentary that's all about other individuals. And what's neat about this as well, and this might help set some of the context of what you were just talking about, it's not just written material, but a lot of it is recorded speeches and sermons. Somebody had a tape recorder going on, that right?
Right, correct.
Okay. And so tell us a little bit about how you just track some of this stuff down, and why, and actually step back and tell me why you wanted to look at some of the lesser known figures, the periphery, so to speak.
Part of it's just historical accident. At some point in the Smithsonian, a trove of video tapes that no one remembered existed was suddenly there, and suddenly people were offering to preserve it and transcribe it and do these sorts of things, and we wanted to take a look at that. That's called the Moses Moon Collection, and it's just amazing that it exists and that people found it and other people had the resources to help us transcribe these and pull them together. The intent is sort of I would call it an archaeology of or recovery of artifacts. And in our initial thinking, this would have been about 2004, 2005, we were talking about the book, and very quickly I realized we were using the wrong term, but we were talking about it as an anthology. We're going to find all this stuff. And within a few months, I realized this is a snowball sampling, and we're going to go all over the place, and we're going to find all kinds of interesting stuff. But we have no idea how much is out there, and we're probably not going to find, I don't know what percentage of it we're going to find in our lifetimes. And so we're going to keep gathering it as much as we can, and then someone else will have to do it when we no longer can. One of the things is an archaeology or a recovery of artifacts. The second is to give credit to people who sacrificed their well-being just as much as the famous people did. They're an important part of history, and we don't know them yet. Relative to the video artifacts and the audio artifacts, this is extremely humbling. And when things are going well for us, we'll find a terrific fully texted speech that's just sitting in someone's file, and it's written, and it's, like elite type from whatever manual typewriter in the time. And when it's not going easily for us, then it's an audio, and with audio, you have all kinds of varying qualities, and sometimes it sounds like there are aliens in the background making strange sounds, or you don't really know what's going on. But one of the most humbling facts is the idiomatic expressions from these people. Many of these people would have been born and lived most of their lives in one county or maybe two counties. And so they would have vocabulary that only people from that era in those one or two counties understood. And a lot of times we just have to put brackets in the text and say, this is what we think they said, but we really don't understand them. And the other thing about trying to translate slang and hemming and hawing and things like this is if you are too careful about dialect and you start putting it out there like Uncle Remus, it detracts from the intelligence of the people that are there. And we never know when we have it at our most accurate or a little less accurate, but it's a very humbling process.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about this Moses Moon archive, because you talk about this in the introduction of your second volume of being able to just stumble across this. And I guess these were a lot of audio tapes. I thought they were audio tapes, might be videotapes. And the other thing I'm interested about, too, these things now are almost 60 years old. So maybe when you're looking, I'm 50 to 60 years old. A lot of them probably really frail and, it might even be water damaged or something. It must have been really emotionally moving to actually hold one of these pieces from 50 years ago and then put it into a tape recorder and start listening to it, because it's a piece of history, but it just seems so fragile. You would think like, oh, I don't want to break this and lose this forever.
It's always like that. And from my part of the research, I run into those occasionally. I ran into quite a few of those in Wisconsin, at University of Wisconsin Historical Society, and I wasn't convinced that they were high enough quality to use in most cases. But even with the paper archives, you're dealing with the same sensation. And you can, you start learning to, at least within one collection, recognize, oh, this is an early 50s or a mid 60s, just by the texture of the paper. And then you can get back into, depending on the collection, the 30s or the 20s or the 10s. And suddenly it's crumbling as you handle it, and you realize, I can't tell this person's story. Someone else, I hope, has done it, but it's not going to happen here at this time. And then you box it up and hope you haven't done too much damage. So it's an emotionally expensive investment when you're dealing with artifacts that are well. And I guess I'm getting long in the tooth myself, so I'm feeling a little bit like those artifacts. The more I do it as well.
Yeah, one of the interesting notes that you or Davis put in the introduction, I know you jointly wrote it together, and I assume that you're roughly the same age, we're all roughly the same age here, is that a lot of these documents were written or recorded at a time when we were pretty much toddlers. And yep. So this is one of those moments to go back into our lifetime and say, okay, right when I came into the world, this was going on, and somebody down the street or a few states south of me or east of me is saying this at this moment in time. That must have been really humbling or amazing. I mean, what kind of thinking was going through your head?
There's empathy, and there's a realization, too, that there are some heroic things going on that, given my generation, I can't imagine. Someone like Martin Luther King deciding 12-year-olds can go on a march with us, and then thinking at some point in the past, let's say 6 years ago, I would have had a 12-year-old daughter, and thinking, I couldn't do that. I'd say, you know what, why not have a slumber party or something?
Yeah.
I don't think I would have been as courageous as the stuff I saw going on. And it's something you have to face up to.
And you know, when you put this in the context of what happened to Robert Spike and to Bruce William Clunder, the risks were very high.
Yep.
I can't imagine
that. And in both cases, having young children survive them.
Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned that you did was to track down some of the survivors. So you would find a document, a tape recording, and it might have a certain name on it. And, you hopefully find the person and go back and talk to him. And again, this is going to be 50 years hence.
Yes.
What was that like? And, this sounds like really cool sleuthing, not the kind of stuff that I am typically doing in my own research. And so this must be very different. And then what is the reaction when you meet one of these people? You have the tape from 50 years ago, and then all of a sudden they're in the living room across from you.
Well, there are fewer and fewer of them. However, these are the sorts of people, these are ministers that are fairly abstemious and are careful with their health, and so there are more of them than there would be if we weren't dealing with this sort of population, or we're dealing with their children. In every case, we feel like we're cold calling, but in most, I would say in 99% of the cases, the families are just sitting around and waiting for the right person to call them, and they want to be a part of this. And that's uniform, whether it's Thurgood Marshall's widow or, you know, choose a name, any of these families that that were participating actively in this. It's also humbling. I want to be someone who regards history carefully, and I also understand that there are times when history... It's just the wrong time in terms of being sensitive to people. And so we'll tell people, look, this is what we want to write, and let us know if you can't deal with this yet. And in many cases, families, the Spike family being one of them, have not survived the trauma. It's still too painful. I shouldn't probably name too many more specific names, but I'm thinking of one family in particular that lost the father to their family, and I believe there were four kids at the time, and they have all of his effects very, very meticulously stored, and it's too painful for them to open the box and get stuff out yet, and it will be another generation before they're ready to deal with that, and we're okay with it. I mean, we have to be okay with it. That's just how it works, but there's the constant tension between I want to tell the story that happened, and also these people are still being bludgeoned by all this, and it's not right for us to push too hard.
Now, this is a monumental task. You must have been driving and flying all over the place. So, you know, did you?
Yeah.
Where'd you get the funding for this, and the time?
Oh, just summers, and I have to. You know, the longer we're in academia, the more people want us to administrate things.
Yeah.
And so that's difficult because there are other things to be done just to keep colleges running as well as they're running. So I had to say no to a lot of things, and I had to be working with people who supported me in that. There are a lot of small places that are teaching colleges like where I am where, quite frankly, there wouldn't have been the support from faculty. I got a colleagues necessary to be able to do this sort of thing. I got a Kaiser Fellowship to take care of some of it. I also received a Bridwell Fellowship from Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University, and they gave me an apartment and just set me up in their archive for the minimum was a month, but I was welcome to spend the whole year there if I wanted to. They were just wonderful, and they supported us as well. And let's see, Davis. Oh, there was someone at Furman University that got a grant to transcribe things. So I guess it's just sort of nickeling and diming, and then it's the opportunity cost of our labor when we're not in the classroom teaching to be able to do that. I forgot about this. For Volume 1, this was unheard of. Baylor Press refuses to do this. They will never front in advance. They advanced several thousand dollars to pay for a few, not that much, but pay for permissions if we needed to from some of the people we wanted to approach. So then later we were able to pay for that out of our royalties pretty quickly, but the fact that they would advance several thousand dollars for research costs is, I suppose, it's unheard of with most university presses.
And we should have a big shout out to Baylor University Press there, because we are a Baylor supported podcast here, and there's, you know, they didn't ask us to do this. I'm just connecting with an old friend here to find out what he's up to, but you know, Baylor to go out and push this project forward, and as you say, it's voluminous, it's heavy, is pretty incredible. Let's go ahead and dive into some of this voluminous material here, and I have to admit that I only have a copy of the second of your two volumes on religion and rhetoric in the civil rights movement. So I only have, I think, about 12 pounds of the material that you have. And it contains about 50 speeches. And I would imagine that the first volume has about the same or if not more. Is that right?
First volume, 133 sounds right.
Wow. Okay. So
yeah,
now,
it was massive. Yeah. And I should, another shout out, Carrie Newman, even after we gave him the 1,700 page manuscript, and it was over 1,000 pages in print, and it was 3 pounds to publish. When we talked to him at lunch, on the debut at the conference, when we were the opening day for when the book was out, he said, "Yeah, volume two sounds good."
Uh-huh. Very cool. and
so yeah, after it.
And starting to parse it down. So the second one is about 50. You said the first one is about 133 or so, give or take a few. And, you know, to do this, you know, to talk, this has been a very long process in the making. You've listened to hours and hours and hours of videotape, and you track down other archival sources. I'm sure some of the material was probably left on the cutting room floor, might be coming out in future volumes. But what was the deciding factor between keeping something in, putting it in the first volume, holding it off to the second volume, or just saying, yeah, we can't use this?
Well, and again, everything we've found, we intend to move forward with in a different venue. We're done with our book projects on this for now, but we do have other venues. And I'll put in a plug. There's a new student research journal that we've called Zerithius, and in addition to publishing student stuff. And you're always welcome on the editorial board.
Okay.
If you want to join us.
Yeah, that goes to the, as you get older in academia, they want more administrative tasks out of you. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. And we intend to continue to publish artifacts we find in this setting. It's a public access. It doesn't... there's no physical space in this journal. It's just on my Google Plus account at St. Joseph's College, and we're going to keep moving forward with things slowly. How to get them into the two books. We liked when we saw something from someone that we'd never heard in our lives. We don't know who this person is. It's amazing to us that this person, once we find out about their life, risked their personal well-being to say these sorts of things without bodyguards near them or anything else. So many of them lost their jobs. Some lost their lives. All of them there was a generation or two generations where their families were deeply traumatized by all these events. And that still isn't over for many of them. So we liked if we just had never heard of someone. We also liked if something was, how would I put this? I don't want to say sacred text or cliche, but I'll say this. Everyone reads Amos and then reads it out loud to people when they talk about civil rights. And so we saw a lot of those. But when people got more creative with different parts of the Bible and the Old Testament than we had heard before, that interested us. And Davis being in communication, when there were rhetorical approaches that jumped out at us as being different, those rose to the top too. And then for volume two, we negotiated the entire time, and volume two is about 500 pages, and we hoped it would be more, but we understood that, you know, there are limits to everything, and so we abided by the limit. And then the people that we found that we haven't gotten in yet, we'll keep after. In volume two as well, we like to address our weak spots. So the other work with University Press of Mississippi was solely on women, just because we had so much difficulty finding them, and people said, "Hey, where are the women?" And we said, "You're right, where are they?" And so we found them, and University Press of Mississippi was very eager to work with us on that. other weaknesses, we could not get close enough. We did not get close enough to synagogues. And so in Volume 1 we had a few rabbis, And we still don't have enough, but I think we tried to really find out. We went to Hebrew Union Seminary in Cincinnati and tried to find out what other places to go to, and we're still not great at that, but we're working on it.
Mm-hmm. I love this approach, too, that you're purposely choosing people who are not that well known, because these are the common voices that oftentimes get overlooked, and the things that they say are oftentimes as profound, if not more profound, given the fact that they're at the grassroots in terms of what other famous people are saying. Let me ask you this. You mentioned early on, you know, certain linguistic things that kept coming up, different slang terms that might kept coming up, and you just mentioned again that Amos was always read out in a lot of these sermons and speeches. Are there other themes that you saw develop, and also this period that you're covering, 1954 to 1965, roughly a decade, are there any changes? Was the rhetoric back in the mid-50s different than what it ended up in the mid-60s?
As best I can tell, I don't know if it's bandwagoning, but people became more confident in the 60s. And then we've cut off in 65 purposefully, but if we take it further, even a year or two, by 66, there seems to be some more anger, and it's connected to Vietnam, perhaps. And so by cutting it off a year earlier than that, we were able to focus, hopefully, on just the people who really, really thought about civil rights and didn't connect it to other very important issues that would overshadow it in terms of its importance and influence on what they were thinking. You're just taking a huge risk in 1954 or 1955. And it's like, let's see, relative to time, those are about the only things. Relative to gender, I had a talk with Mark Knoll when the women's volume came out in 2009, and he thought, and I think he's right about this, he thought, you know, women don't hold their punches in the stuff you put out there. With ministers, there's a board of trustees or deacons or elders. There's someone out there so that every time you talk, you want to be polite. And the people that aren't of the cloth don't have that, I don't know what to call it. I wouldn't call it a limitation. It's probably good to be polite most of the time.
Maybe a reservation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there might have been a gender breakdown relative to how hard-hitting they were.
And that's a very interesting finding in and of itself. Yeah. I mean, just to see that the people who may not be in the same institutional context as a preacher have the ability to punch a little bit harder just yeah. because of who they are. Yeah, that's interesting. And what about themes in the Bible? I mean, are there certain themes that always tend to come up? I mean, one would think that Exodus is always
Exodus,
going to be there.
Amos. I didn't. This would not have. I know I know Samaritans were the wrong kinds of people, and people wanted to avoid them. But I had forgotten that Jesus walked the long way around the lake through Samaria to get to his destination at one point, and that interested me. There are things like, some other things that jump out is I'm pretty sure Solomon is African. I think his mother Bathsheba is from Africa. Mm-hmm. And I think Song of Songs mentions it, and I'm not sure if another source does. And the other thing people mention too, we're talking about the ancient Near East, and so to divide people up into white and black is a little bit more simple than anything that could have possibly have happened in Palestine. People are a mixture of everything. You're right there near northern Africa. You're on the way to the east if you take a right. And then I think people focus, too, there are certain founding fathers of the church that we all know about who are actually African. Augustine of Hippo. Hippo is where Tunisia, some place that was part of Carthage in northern Africa. And so to decide, well, we're going to put these people in a separate hotel, even though Augustine of Hippo was from Africa. I mean, what would we do with him if he were to come here? Some other themes that were maybe bureaucratic rather than biblical were, we have missions in all these places, and we want our missionaries in Africa and Asia to come back and be able to talk to us. And how do we tell them, honestly, we want to recruit you, and then once we bring them here to visit, say, well, we want to recruit you, but you have to stay over there when we bring you here across the ocean to talk to our congregation. So there were difficulties like that as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting theme. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, if you're out there missionizing in different parts of the world, and then you say, you know, come back for training, come back to meet our congregation, and you're trying to preach the good word, and all of a sudden it's you know, there's the white section and the black section there. Yeah. That doesn't do too well for you,
no.
Right? That's a very interesting theme too. One of just those little institutional tweaks that you might not necessarily think about or know about.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go ahead and dig into some of the actual speeches. I mean, you got 133 plus 50 plus all the other ones that, you know, haven't made it into the text that are on your website and have yet to still be seen. Give us some of your favorites, some of the ones that were most touching or most surprising or most humorous or, you know, most whatever it might be.
Okay. I'll start in the 2006 volume. There's a speech by Horace Mann Bond, and that's Julian Bond's father. And Julian didn't know that the speech existed, but it's this incredible guilt trip where he's visiting a white man on death row who's illiterate, and the white man tries to bum a cigarette off him before he's executed, and Horace Mann Bond doesn't give it to him. And then how he dealt with that, just... You can't imagine things like that happening, and people trying to be thoughtful as they happen. there's a very funny one.
Well, actually, let me stop you on that Horace Mann Bond. So this set the context a little bit more in the story. So it's a story about a prisoner on death row and whether or not they're going to get a cigarette.
He's a sociologist with a ministerial background, if I'm remembering this correctly, and he's there to comfort some people on death row, and they sing hymns. And it's pretty clear from how the guy sings a hymn that he's not reading the text. He's trying to listen to everyone else because he probably doesn't read. And then he asks this person that's there to help him feel a little bit better if he can bum a cigarette. And then the answer is no.
And this is a story that Horace Mann Bond is telling, correct?
Yes.
And is he telling this to a congregation? Is this to a open, you know, town hall meeting? Or what is the context of this story coming out?
It's a religious event.
Okay. And a lot of these are, too. I guess I would have to say a lot of these are sermons that were given in congregations on a Sunday morning or perhaps a gathering on a Thursday evening. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's an interesting one, and why you know why do you think he emphasizes that theme, and what do you remember what year that was from?
Let's see if I can get it quickly. 1956.
Okay, so this is pretty early in the period.
Very early, and I think that one of the themes that a lot of these deal with is all of this stuff is broken. It's not that one group of people is broken. It's just we're in the habit of doing these things that's ruined all of us.
Uh-huh.
And little by little, we have to figure, be thoughtful about all those little situations where things are broken now and we have to go about fixing them.
Yeah, that's an interesting theme. It's not only a reflection upon you know, the black community, but it's a reflection upon the entire society.
Yep. And another similar theme to that is that racism, of course, hurts the victim, but racism creates the victim of the racist. the person who thinks the bad thought is throwing himself in the ditch with the person he's trying to bury by being a worse human than he otherwise would be.
That's an interesting theme to come out to, because it's one that promotes more cooperation in this movement rather than conflict. Saying, you know, instead of just leave me alone, you're wrong, but it's saying, listen, we're in this together. Here's what's happening to you at the same time. I can see that's a very conciliatory and very Christian type of message coming out.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
very cool. So what other ones are out there?
There's a fellow named Percy Dale East. Real tragic life. Grew up pretty much an orphan in a sawmill. He was sort of the lowest class of human except for the black people. And so when he saw a black kid, he actually growing up thought he had more in common with the black kids than he did with the white kids because he was from such an impoverished background. And at some point he becomes a journalist, and he's also, maybe it's just a difficult upbringing, and probably he's reacted to it poorly, and it's also people are firebombing his house, and so he's not even living with his wife and children because he doesn't want them to be in a place where he gets bombed. But he also has a not just a reputation from other people, a self-described reputation of enjoying a libation now and again. And so he's invited by the dean of Dillard University to give a chapel speech, and his chapel speech is a conceit on the cocktail he would mix to fix racism. And he dies one of these tragic deaths later that people given over to libations a bit too much die of. And so just the irony that he would use this conceit that was so tragic in his life to describe how to fix the larger problems he was dealing with was that I just thought it was extremely creative. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah. It's an interesting story, too, because here's a white guy you're including into this volume speaking to this, and you can see the connections that he's making with the oppression that he's seeing around him, and then connecting this to, I don't know, maybe he saw the own tragedy in his story as well, but one of the things that I love that you do in these volumes is that you document a bit about the contextual history of each of the authors to the extent that you can. I mean, some of these people still remain somewhat unknown or opaque in their histories, but the histories of the people and then what they say combined in this volume makes it just a fascinating read.
Some of the stories, too, I don't really care about the stories, but I have... that's not true. I care about the stories. They're terrific. But I have a contextual connection to the family for whatever reason. There's a fellow named Colbert Cartwright, who was one of the white ministers who accompanied the Little Rock Nine to school in 1957 when they were integrating Central High School. And I got to introduce his widow, Reverend Cartwright's widow and daughter, to Ambassador Andrew Young a week after the groundbreaking for the Stone of Hope Memorial. And I have photos of that somewhere, too, of those people meeting. And that was just fun to be there when they had a chance to interact. And it was very clear that the amount of experience they had in common. There's a lot of trauma, and it happens to your family. And then the people that connect in that context are very open, talking to each other about similar circumstances. There's a fellow named George Chauncey who also accompanied the Little Rock Nine to school in 1957, and his son recently was snagged from the University of Chicago faculty. George Chauncey Jr., or he might be, I think he's junior, is on the Yale history faculty, and he actively writes amici curiae briefs to gender-based cases using exactly the same reasoning that the civil rights people did in the 1950s and 1960s. Hmm. And he's had some decent success with that.
So that's interesting. You just gave me a shiver up the spine when you were talking about Pastor Cartwright, because, again, this is something that, you know, goes back to our childhood. You know, we were just being born or walking around when all this stuff is happening. And then at a certain point in time, you know, some 50 years later, all of a sudden the paths start intersecting again. And it's just, wow. It's touching history in ways that is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
What are some of the other stories here? One that you mentioned to me when you sent me a copy of the book was James Baldwin. And you said you really liked the humor in his speeches because he, it's interesting because, again, you know, you might think that a lot of anger, a lot of despair might be coming out of this, but people address these things in different ways, oftentimes using humor.
Yeah, and self-deprecating humor. And then Baldwin as an African-American. He's an expatriate. He lives in France. He can use words so viciously, but he won't turn them necessarily on other people. He'll say stereotypical things about himself or deny things about himself using language that you and I could not have gotten away with, that he can. And it comes across, and you can hear too when you're listening to the audio. You can hear from the shape of his vowels that he spent some time in France, and that's changed how he speaks English a little bit. And his voice is this relentless staccato. It reminded me of a manual typewriter with no ribbon, and it just comes at you and at you and at you and at you. And the other thing about that was, he has developed this incredible rapport with Reinhold Niebuhr, and I'm a big Reinhold Niebuhr fan. And Niebuhr actually was on this show right after the Birmingham 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. And he's been through a series of strokes, but he's still incredibly articulate. And he very clearly has this intense admiration from this expatriate, James Baldwin, who has this extremely harsh tone. And at some point in the show, Baldwin decides that he wants every American to boycott Christmas shopping. And just the fact that he would do that, I mean, that's a big deal for everyone not to buy Christmas gifts. And as I was transcribing it and thinking that through, I thought, how many people have I ever heard of that came up with an imaginary or real character to have an idea this extreme? And I could only think of two others that outdid James Baldwin. One would be Dr. Seuss with the Grinch, and the other one would be Mr. Scrooge, mm-hmm. Charles Dickens. James Baldwin is in pretty elite company when it comes to anti-heroes of the winter solstice.
that is fascinating. Actually, this brings up something very interesting, because the books that we will link to on our website, that's all written, and you sit down in a chair and you read through this, but you got to see these things on video, or you listen to them, mm-hmm. and there must be a situation where it's just difficult to translate some of this. As you mentioned, the staccato of James Baldwin's voice that comes through, that doesn't make it on the page. Are we losing something in this translation?
All we can do, and I think we've done this in that case and several others, is say, this is the best we could do given our resources at the time, but we encourage students and scholars, you got to go hear this. You got to get on this audio. And the internet is terrific for preserving this stuff in the best possible state we can at this point, so that people can rehear it and rehear it, because no doubt we made mistakes, and other people will have a better ear and fix it. However long it takes, they'll fix it.
What other interesting sermons or speeches really touched you?
Let's start with the 09 book on the women.
Okay.
And these, again, are just personal things that happened. The speeches are wonderful, but just there were personal things going on that put them over the top for me. Agnes Meyer was Eugene Meyer's wife, and Eugene Meyer and Agnes by the Washington Post in 1933, sounds right to me, when it's on the ropes and it's in bankruptcy proceedings. And at some point, someone got a copy of the book to Catherine Weymouth, who was publisher of the Washington Post at the time.
Okay.
And she sent me a very kind handwritten note thanking me for preserving her. I'm thinking Agnes Meyer is her great-grandmother. But I don't remember for certain. But that was a wonderful experience to just have someone go out of their way and thank me for preserving their family's intellectual property.
And so what other ones? There's Agnes Meyer from in the past in this women's volume. Are there any other ones that touch you?
Barbara Posey is very, very humorous, and we can't even describe exactly how humorous she is at the time. She's a teenager. And for most textbooks, they're going to tell you and tell us that the sit-in movement starts in Greenville, North Carolina, in about 1960 or 1961. Well, this Barbara Posey character actually is the earliest we know about, and she's from Oklahoma, and she did this in Oklahoma in 1958. And then her speech, we had to be very vague, and even when we were vague, some of the things we wrote about it were cut out. But she makes reference that two boys that she had recently been talking to were laughing about the color of Dwight D. Eisenhower's golf balls.
Huh. Okay.
And that's as specific as I can get, really.
Ah, okay.
People will have to read it and see what they think for themselves.
It's a family show.
We at least preserved everything we could.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the most important one, and this actually is in your bailiwick, Rita Schwerner was the widow, 25-year-old widow of Mickey Schwerner, one of the three people killed in Mississippi during the summer of 1964. And they were activists who came down from the Northeast and tried to get people to register to vote. Rita has since become a high-powered attorney there in Seattle, Washington. And when I approached her, and we found this incredible deposition that she gave right after she found out that her husband was dead, where she reproduced about the last 6 weeks of her life with just so meticulously. We were shocked by it. When we showed her the speech and asked her for permission, she said, "Oh my gosh, I don't remember giving that deposition."
Uh-huh.
And she's an attorney.
Yeah, well, it must have been a shocking moment in her life, too. I mean, you go
clearly
through.
Clearly in an advanced state of shock.
Right.
That the sort of thing where days and weeks go by and you lose track of them. That sort of shock. And certainly that seems an appropriate response as well. Sort of thing that would help you survive.
I want to ask you about one more thing, and before we finish off with some questions on your general reflections on this project, you mentioned Ed Harris earlier on, and that you were able to uncover some documents that were left uncovered until his death that dealt with some of the incidents in the church. And this might be an interesting thing to look into, because there's going to be disputes within this movement and, you know, different directions that people want to go. What did you find with those Ed Harris documents?
Well, he gave perhaps the most carefully. He did so much research, and he looked through all the constitutional documents of the Methodist Church, every single authority he could find, and divided it out. He laid it out very, very carefully and said to his community that, as best I can tell, given everything I can see about Methodism and this church and all the rules that we need to follow, what we have to do is integrate. And he showed the document to the Methodist bishops in advance, and then they told him they were 100% in support of him, told it to his congregation, and was summarily removed from the church. And it's something that emotionally he didn't recover from the rest of his life. He had insomnia, anxiety, depression, all kinds of things. And he lived a long life, but he had an awful lot of trauma the rest of his life, too, as a result. And his wife, I think, is in the process, if she hasn't yet, of writing a book telling about the entire experience. But just to see someone be so careful and play by the rules and have the rules fail him when he's doing the right thing, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's, you can feel a lot of the burden that people are carrying when you listen to the speeches, when you read the speeches and the books that you've, in the speeches that you put into your book. And it's very moving. I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read a number of them and I find them to be extremely moving. I want to hear in the few minutes we have left over, boomerang back to your previous work on Latin America in light of all this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. We should talk about the Pope a little bit, too.
We should. I want to get your, because you're Catholic and I'm not, and I want to get your thoughts on that. But one of the things I'm always interested in is, and especially as I grow older here, is how scholars look back on their work. And so a lot of the different things that they've looked at in their past, how they sew that together in a garment, so to speak. And are looking back on this project and your reflections upon that and your earlier work and the work that you still do in Latin America, are there themes that you start to see develop? And, you know, what has this project taught you about some of your earlier scholarship and vice versa?
Well, first off, the common thread that I haven't changed, no matter what my focus is I like to end anonymity. If someone has an idea and it's contributing to change in good ways, I want to uncover that as best I can. And I think, liberation theology jargon from back in the day, there would have been a phrase, something like voice of the voiceless. Maybe face of the faceless. I'm trying to give people their due in any possible way I can. And that's a common thread that goes throughout. Some things I see in common between looking at the civil rights movement and looking at liberation theology groups and post-liberationist groups. First off, there are a few people, usually Catholics or Lutherans, who are reading everything at the same time and see how the University of Louvain applies to Gandhi and vice versa. And that's amazing to me because it's taken me so long to see that, and someone was there in real time with no internet and pulling all of that together. Niebuhr is one of these people. Maybe Hesburgh, but I don't think he pulled it together till 64 or 65. And there's a fellow named Daniel German who's at University of Santa Clara for much of his career, and he's pulling them all together. And he sees, wow, I'm sitting here talking to people in Louisiana, and this has something to do with Louvain, Belgium, and it has something to do with Latin American poor neighborhoods, too. And he sees it at the same time. And that's just colossal to me that someone could have been in a place and had just that moment in time to prepare and learn that and see that it all added up. Some other things that are interesting to me are, first off, that the Patronato Real de los Indios from the early 16th century, I think we should teach as part of U.S. constitutional history. And the reason I think that is that when Portugal and Spain and the Pope get in a room and decide what they're going to do about slavery, they create Brazil and say there can be slavery there, and there's going to be slavery in Brazil till something like 1888, maybe a little bit earlier than that. That's creating an international context where Southerners in the United States can be belligerent and say, if you don't, it's my way or the highway. If you don't cooperate with me, I'm just going to take my property and I'm going to charter a boat and go to Brazil. And so those two things are related. And I think if at somehow in the 16th century, if Portugal and Spain and the papacy could have handled things slightly differently, I think things could have gone slightly better in the United States. Maybe not that much better, but maybe slightly better. And the other thing that I think is similar about the two cases, I think you have sort of a one-party dominant system like Mexico was, or maybe Paraguay back in the day, looks a little bit like what was going on in the South, let's say from the fall of the Radical Republicans in the late 19th century to about 1954, maybe 1965. And I should say something about the Pope.
We'll close on that because he's from Latin America. You're a Latin Americanist, and he has this to fit with the theme that you're talking about. And I love the theme that you have too, is just giving anonymity its due respect and allowing people to speak. Because I'm a big fan of the wisdom of common folk, so to speak. And this Pope seems to be that kind of guy.
He's from such a unique place that I think will make him it looks to me like he will be the most effective pope in my lifetime. The things I like about him are, first of all, he's practical mm-hmm. about social issues. And second of all, in addition to that practicality, he has experienced Argentina. And Argentina is a highly secular society, and he experiences Argentina as something that he has to deal with practically, but it's also something that where he would think, I'm something different. I have a critical perspective of this place, and the world I'm trying to create is going to be much different than a Buenos Aires. In Argentina, soccer is a religion, and Sigmund Freud is a religion. Christianity, not so much. And he's in that place where he can both be practical about the realities that are out there, but also critical about them. And I think very few people, very few Catholic leaders get to be in that place where they're anchored in a couple of different places that are going to be useful.
And it's also Argentina is one of those places where the church as an institution hasn't had the greatest history, so to speak.
Yep.
And, you know, he's somebody who, you know, was in that environment when the church, many high church leaders were collaborating with the dictatorial regimes in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, a very practical guy. I mean, he's seen a lot of different things throughout his life and really has to bring that to fore in his theology and his daily doings. Well, Dave, it has been a pleasure catching up with you. We'll have to hit some conference at some point in time or another. I'm sure our paths will cross many other times. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for calling, and great to talk to you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.